From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It has been a long, hard-fought midterm race, and it's not over.
And folks, make no mistake, the math is on our side to win this election.
If I wasn't your first choice, or if you made no choice at all, you're going to have a chance to do a do-over.
Republican gubernatorial candidate Brian Kemp has not declared victory, and Democrat Stacey Abrams has not yet conceded. And Georgia's sixth congressional district, the race between incumbent Karen Handel and Democrat Lucy McBath, still too close to call. So where do we go from here? GPB's Ross Terrell and Stephen Fowler are filling us in. Ross was at Republican Brian Kemp's watch party last night, and Stephen was there with Abrams' camp, both until the wee small hours. So thanks, guys, so much for being here.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen, let's start with you, with Abrams. Here she is. This was just before 2 o'clock this morning.
But I'm here tonight to tell you votes remain to be counted. There are voices that were waiting to be heard. Across our state, folks are opening up the dreams of voters in absentee ballots, and we believe our chance for a stronger Georgia is just within reach.
Stephen Abrams seems to be angling for a runoff, but can you explain for us the distinction between a recount and a runoff?
Yeah, so what Abrams was mentioning last night and the campaign talking points moving forward is that right now there are less than 70,000 votes that separate her from Secretary of State Brian Kemp. And with more absentee mail-in ballots that remain to be counted, as well as provisional ballots that need to be could be corrected by Friday, there is a hope that Brian Kemp's margin can go below 50%. Abrams is below 50%, and this would move to a runoff in December. Now, a recount would be if Brian Kemp wins and Stacey Abrams falls within 1% of the total vote difference between them. So he gets 50.1 and she gets 49.1. Then there could be a recount where Abrams could ask for the counties and all across the state to recount all their votes, make sure everything is in and accurate, and see if that changes the total at all.
You said provisional ballots and mail-in ballots still awaiting. All counties in?
Most of the counties, almost all of the counties are completely in, done, wrapped up with a bow, ready to be certified. But some Metro Atlanta counties like Fulton, Cobb, and Gwinnett counties still have massive amounts of absentee mail-in ballots that need to be counted. And last night they said they would count them in the morning. So those are some of those tens of thousands of ballots that could send this race to a runoff.
Let's talk about what would happen if it does go to a runoff. Would take place December 4th. Libertarian Ted Metz, he got about 1% of the vote. How would his voters turn out? Would they make the difference in an outcome any different than yesterday's?
Well, the turnout for a runoff would probably be markedly lower than what we've seen for this general election. Right now, there's about 3.9 million ballots that have been cast. You won't see 3.9 million people voting in December, most likely. Now, with Libertarian Ted Metz, his closing pitch in the race was, if you don't like either one of them, vote for me. And so it's not clear whether Libertarian votes will go to Stacey Abrams or Brian Kemp, or if there are people that will just stay home.
Ross, what does Kemp think about the idea of a recount or runoff?
I don't think he thinks it's going there. At the end of the night, he's stopped short of declaring victory and kind of made the pitch saying, you know, I'm ready to be your next governor. There are reasons why I got into this. Here are those reasons I made promises. So he's not really talking like this is going in that direction.
So here's a little bit from his speech last night.
I entered public service out of frustration. I wanted to make it easier for hardworking Georgians to build a better life for their families.
Does that sound like a victory speech or a campaign speech?
A little of both. I think he had to walk a line. I mean, he didn't come out until almost 3 a.m. And I think a lot of that was kind of figuring out how to strike the right tone of hearing what Abrams had to say, not declaring victory, but also sounding confident that it looks like if everything falls the way we think, I'm going to be the next governor.
So the mood in the room at the end of the night, or how many were still hanging on at 3 a.m.?
The attendance was like a bell curve. People trickled in. There was definitely a high point where the room was probably about 85% full. By the end of the night, you're looking at maybe 200 to 300, a definite drop off. But overall, it stayed the same. The same few country songs on repeat, the same excitement. I mean, when he came out, people were cheering, signs, chanting. So I don't think they were too nervous.
All right. So it was expected that the race would be certainly close. But do you think the campaigns were prepared for this outcome?
I think both campaigns were prepared. I think, you know, Brian Kemp's campaign knew that this was going to be a tight, close race, and it would come down to who turned out for him and who turned out for Stacey Abrams. But the Abrams campaign was prepared as well. One of the campaign staffer told me early in the night that they have contingency plans A, B, and C if this happens, and plans for those plans. So they had different scenarios, and one of them, it seems like, was for a runoff, and that's why they were able to come out and say, every vote has to be counted. We believe there are votes in Democratic areas, and this is going to be done. Do not despair.
So that sounds like all legitimate votes counted. However, we know there was a big talking point from the Abrams campaign, accusations of voter suppression by Secretary of State's office, a couple of lawsuits as well. In fact, a lawsuit filed yesterday, just yesterday, by a group of Georgia voters wanting to put a federal injunction against Brian Kemp as Secretary of State against being in charge of any kind of runoff. Who actually decides if there's a runoff and who's in charge of the recount?
Well, so a runoff, the numbers decide if there's a runoff. If people are below 50%, then that's what goes there according to state law. But the recount can be requested by a candidate. So if the roles were reversed and Stacey Abrams was up by 1% over Brian Kemp, he could request a runoff that then he, as Secretary of State, could approve. So, but it's done at a state level, and then all of the counties can be asked. Like, individual counties can do what's called a re-canvass, which is where they go over their votes and make sure everything's counted. And so there are 159 counties that can re-canvass, but all of them would have to participate in a recount for a statewide race like this. And then it's ultimately the Secretary of State's office that directs those counties. Here's how you need to do. Here's when you need to do it by, and let us know what it says.
So the numbers dictate the runoff, of course, but still the Secretary of State's office would be in charge of it. If it is a contested race at this point, would the Secretary of State's office still oversee the race? Or Brian Kemp, rather, as Secretary of State?
Well, again, there's 159 counties with 159 elections officials and things like that. So it's done at a county level, but it falls under the umbrella of the Elections Division of the Secretary of State's office. So nominally speaking, at least, Brian Kemp would be overseeing the runoff recount process. But if it does go to a runoff, he most likely will step down from that so he can fundraise while the legislative special session happens next week. Because as a statewide elected official, he would not be able to fundraise while the legislature is in session, which normally wouldn't be a problem. But we've got the special session coming up, and he's not going to lose out on a week of fundraising in a tight runoff. So I would imagine he would step down at that point, but it remains to be seen.
That's GPB's Stephen Fowler. Ross Terrell is also here with us. We're talking about the still undecided Georgia governor's race. Brian Kemp described this election as a battle for the soul of our state. So what do we know about the soul or the state of Georgia's soul at this moment?
I think at this point, he kind of mentioned in his speech, you know, I promise to put families first, to put people first. And I think you have a Republican legacy on the line here. You're talking now, he will be succeeding Governor Deal, who during his term loves to tout the fact that Georgia was ranked number one for business 6 years in a row. He was there last night. One thing that I did find interesting in all of this was some people I talked to last night actually had concerns the other way about voting. As we know, some polls are open late because of some voting issues, and they were concerned that that was going to unfairly help the Democrats, which I found that to be a little interesting. But the soul of the state right now is, I think, keeping that Republican legacy and keeping Georgia a state to do business in.
But let's look at his mandate. You know, this is something that politicos love to talk about, a landslide in a race with a few bumps, strong mandate. But that's thought to give an official more power to get things done. But if Kemp, in the end, does narrowly win amid talk of voter suppression, what happens to his mandate? Will that make him tougher for him to govern?
It may make him tougher for him to earn the trust of Georgians. But I think as far as governing, I don't think it'll change. The people who support him support him. You know, he's been the Secretary of State. You also have the Lieutenant Governor, who was Republican, who won last night, the AG, a number of people on his side who came out and proclaimed victory. So I think as far as legislatively and other lawmakers, it won't make it that much more difficult to get things done other than typical political squabbles.
Now, Russ, of course, we have heard a lot about Georgia turning blue this election season. Doesn't seem to be quite the case, but do we have enough to say maybe it's purple?
I wouldn't go that far yet. There were a lot of Republican victories, and there are still two key races that are too close to tell that those could easily, you know, go red. I mean, you talk about a possible another Republican governor. I wouldn't quite say we're purple just yet, but we could get there.
Stephen, the gubernatorial race gives us a feel for the overall political picture, of course, in Georgia. Rural Georgia, of course, still pretty red. Brian Kemp wins and Republicans do have full control of redistricting. Will Georgia's political landscape accurately reflect its numbers, you know, the true colors, even if it is turning purple?
Well, you know, from the objective standpoint, all politicians will say that redistricting is there to help benefit all Georgians and to make it fair and put the technically same numbers and everywhere in there. But it will be beneficial for Republicans redrawing districts. You know, they're not going to be able to draw things where Georgia will have no Democratic representation. But you look at the broad picture of the results and you have these large metro areas that tend to vote more heavily Democratic. And then you have large swaths of rural Georgia that tend to vote more Republican. And any sort of redistricting that will be done to preserve those existing areas. You're not going to have a congressional district that has part of Macon all the way down to Valdosta and, you know, it takes away the liberal vote there and things like that. But it should, in theory, be pretty accurate with the overall picture of what Georgia looks like.
At the end of the night at the Abrams campaign, what was the spirit like there? There's so many people mobilized to vote, both on the Democrat and Republican side. Is there enough momentum to go through another almost full month of this kind of campaigning?
Well, you know, I don't know if I have the momentum to go through another month, but this, the Georgia Democratic Party and the Stacey Abrams campaign has put together the type of momentum and ground game and organization that really neither political party has seen in recent history. And so, you know, they think that they have the people power to get people to the polls. If you look at this race, they were able to get it within, you know, 2 percentage points now, maybe force it to a runoff. And they have the ability to contact people that they think there's the volunteers that are there to mobilize people to come out. So it won't be another 3.9 million people voting in the runoff, but you will definitely see a lot more participation, especially because this race, if it goes to a runoff, will be the ultimate referendum on voting rights in Georgia.
So waiting game at this point. Ross, you've been talking to the campaign this morning. What kind of things are they saying?
I think last night you got two different messages from the campaign. Some staffers said, you know, this is a nail biter. And others, I asked, do you think you guys are going to win tonight? And they say, yeah, we think we're going to call it that we'll have a winner. And obviously that didn't happen. One thing to keep an eye on is leading up to this race, you had each side bring in proverbially their biggest guns.
Right.
You had Trump and Pence. You had Oprah and Obama. I don't know if you get much bigger than those two people. So this will truly be a test of the candidate reaching voters in areas and really energizing them again for another month if it goes to runoff.
Maybe without the celebrity endorsements.
Correct.
There you go. GPB's Ross Terrell, Stephen Fowler, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I would say get some sleep, but I don't know if that's in the cards. Coming up, we're going to discuss other significant Georgia races with Political Rewind host Bill Nigut. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A record number of Georgians cast their votes in the midterm election yesterday. Contested elections went into the wee hours of the morning, which includes the race for governor in a key congressional district. We're going to catch up with the rest of the races and also look at the state of Georgia's elections as a whole. We have GPB's Bill Nigut. He's host of Political Rewind, up all night working.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. And joining us by the phone is Maya Prabhu. She is State House reporter for the AJC. And Maya, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, good morning. A long night for both of you. A long night for all of us in Georgia. Bill, just how much of a record turnout overall? Did Georgia's elections go the way that folks predicted? Yeah, many people?
You know, it's really, well, first of all, we virtually approached the kind of turnout we see in presidential elections here. We came within about 5% of that, and there's still a few votes out there to count. But here's what really, here's a great way to visualize it. If people go to the Secretary of State's website, there's a map of voter turnout, and that map, it starts at around, I think, green, light green is 50%, counties with 50% of the vote, and it gets darker green as you increase the vote. The entire state of Georgia on that map is one shade of green or another. There are counties where 60, 65% and more of the people voted. That's staggering in a midterm election.
Yes, so a lot of people motivated. And of course, the biggest news on the national level is that Democrats took back the House. So let's start with the races for House seats in Georgia. Sixth District includes Cobb County and Metro Atlanta. There, Democrat Lucy McBath ran against Republican incumbent Karen Handel. As of airtime, still undecided. What's the background on that race, Bill?
First of all, remember, Karen Handel won that big special election when she ran against John Ossoff, the most expensive House race people had ever seen. But it does now appear unlikely that she's going to be able to catch McBath. I don't think the race has been called yet, but Republicans that I'm talking to this morning think that Lucy McBath is going to win that seat. She, of course, Lucy McBath had two big issues. She lost a son to gun violence in a terrible, terrible incident in Florida, and she talked about that. She believes in gun safety laws. But more important, she really emphasized health care and said over and over again that it was the Democrats and she who could deliver a better health care. Make sure to protect ACA, to protect pre-existing conditions. And that seems to have resonated.
Well, Bill, another tight one was in the 7th District in Georgia, also Metro Atlanta. Voted Democrat in 2016 election for the first time since 1976. Their Republican Rob Woodall won the seat despite challenger Carolyn Bordeaux's numbers pretty much climbing throughout the night. In the end, about 50 votes separated the candidates. What does that tell us?
Well, so we should be careful about this because the 7th district encompasses all of Gwinnett County. Gwinnett County did, in fact, go Democrat, elected Hillary, voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. But it also includes a much more pure red county, Forsyth County, above it. And so it is. While Carolyn Bordeaux certainly won Gwinnett County, those Republican voters up in Forsyth are the ones who made that race so terribly close. It does appear that Woodall is going to win this race. But again, we'll see. There are a bunch of absentee ballots, provisional ballots. We'll wait and see what that shows us.
Boy, the wait and see is pretty much the theme of this post-election. Yeah. Secretary of State race going to a runoff also because no candidate got more than 50% of the vote. This is the role that deals with election security, voting rights, taking Brian Kemp's office. It's been a prevailing national story, the role of that office during this election. Has either candidate chimed in on what's going on there?
Well, I mean, what we're going to see happen, and Brian Kemp started this himself, is we've now got a commission in place that the Secretary of State's office has empowered to look at new voting machines. They'll go through their process, see which machines they want, but then it's going to be up to the legislature to fund those machines. That's part of the issue. Can voters in Georgia rely without a paper trail on the accuracy of the machines? Beyond that, this issue of voter suppression will no doubt linger well beyond the election that we just went through. There are Republicans say that the problem with voting in Georgia is that people who shouldn't be voting are somehow doing it. They want to tighten security. Mm-hmm. Democrats are saying, no. What's happening is Republicans are literally trying to suppress potential Democratic votes. And they're going to continue fighting that for months and months to come.
Maya, let's check in on some of the other races that you've been covering for the AGAC. Republican Jeff Duncan won lieutenant governor's race through his support behind his Republican ticket mate.
I'm anxious to work with Brian Kemp, to be a part of this new conservative generation we've got going here. I'm anxious to work with Brian Kemp. I'm anxious to be a part of putting you first.
Any surprises there in that race?
No, not really. We had poll numbers come out last week that showed Sarah Riggs-Amico, the Democrat, within the margin of error, but still trailing Jeff Duncan. So with the excitement around the top of the ticket with Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams, if Amico was going to win, Stacey Abrams would have needed to win. You know, Stacey Abrams would have carried Amico. So right. it's not very surprising that Jeff Duncan, once he cleared the primary, I think it was more surprising that he won the primary. But once he cleared the primary, I don't think it was very surprising that he won last night.
Let's fill in on some other races for Ag Commissioner. Incumbent Gary Black will retain a seat. Here he is last night.
Somehow, maybe we captured your imagination with how important agriculture, because agriculture makes life better for everybody. We will stand with our family in Southwest Georgia.
Super challenging time for Southwest Georgia farmers. We've spoken to many of them. And, of course, a special legislative session is going to be opening on November 13th to allocate funds to clean up and help restore after the hurricane. So what is Black looking to do in that session, Maya?
I talked to him about this during the campaign, and he just said the best that they can do is just continue to support the farmers. You know, there's not really much that they can do. They can't, he said, you know, we can't control the weather, so there's no way to really prepare ahead of time to make sure that farmers don't have their crops wiped out, but just be there to support them when things like the storms happen.
Number of other incumbents retain their seats in statewide election. Mike Butler, reelected Labor Commissioner Richard Wood, will continue as schools superintendent. Chris Carr remain as attorney general. Any real changes otherwise in those races or real challenges, Maya?
No real changes. The only, you know, statewide areas where there might races where there might be some changes are the Secretary of State that might go to, looks like it's going to a runoff, and then in the Public Service Commission, it looks like District 3 might go to a runoff. But other than that, pretty much everyone kept their seats.
So pretty much solid red. But Bill, you mentioned Gwinnett County earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, Gwinnett, one of the most diverse counties in the whole country, finally elected a minority to the county commission for the first time ever.
Yep. They elected two Democrats, by the way, which they haven't had for 30 years on the county commission there. And one of them is the grandson of Chinese immigrants, and he's a gay commissioner. He'll be the first gay commissioner they've had. And the other is an African-American woman. Boy, is Gwinnett County changing.
Yeah, well, this is one of the things that's being looked at as a bellwether, right, for demographic-driven political change in Georgia. So what are we seeing there?
We're seeing Gwinnett County, which is so incredibly diverse, finally step up. And minority voters are feeling empowered in that county for the first time because their numbers continue to increase. So, for instance, Abrams beat Kemp 56-43% in Gwinnett County last night. And that continues the fact that Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump in Gwinnett back in 2016. Gwinnett County has a couple of Senate seats that are going to flip. Fran Millar has been a representative, a legislator for Gwinnett County for years and years. He last night lost to a Democrat, Sally Harrell. And in another race, David Schaefer, who was running for lieutenant governor, a Republican who'd represented Gwinnett for a long, long time, last night that seat also flipped and went to a Democrat, Zara Karinchak. So once again, you see this really remarkable flipping of certain districts and sudden an injection of minority voices into our politics.
Well, I want to circle back around to what you said about the voting irregularity accusations. We got a tweet from Scott Collison. These down ballot and powerful wins, he puts in quotation marks, are ill-gotten. Kemp oversaw his own election. Secretaries of state need to be replaced with independent voters' commissions. How likely, you said this is going to continue to be an issue, how likely is that push going to go, especially with a predominantly Republican Senate and legislature, rather?
Well, I think you could imagine that someone with noble intentions in the next legislative session, not the special session, but the January session, could introduce legislation to call on a Secretary of State to step down from that office, recuse herself or himself when running for an election again. But that's not going to get anywhere. I mean, as long as Republicans are in control of the legislature, they're going to want to maintain the power they can. Although here's an interesting thing. I hadn't even thought about this. If John Barrow, the Democrat, wins the Secretary of State's office, what might Republicans try to do to take a little bit of the wind out of his sails should he decide that he either is going to run for re-election, he wants to run for a higher office? I haven't even given this much thought, but I wonder how they might play with a Democratic Secretary of State in the session ahead. Maybe I'm just running on no sleep, but it might be interesting to see what they could do.
Maya, any thoughts for you there watching the races and also hearing from your colleagues at the AJC? How is that impacting those kind of accusations? How have they affected the election and the sense of how people feel about Georgia's integrity in elections?
You know, I've gotten some, you know, reader emails overnight, kind of thinking conspiracies, like Brian Kemp is a Republican, he's running the election. Don't you find it interesting that all of the Republicans seem to have won by a margin of 51% to 57%? No, I don't necessarily find that interesting because, you know, a lot of people, most of the people that I spoke with after we did our poll voted straight party ticket. Brian Kemp got almost 51% of the vote. So it makes sense that others who are Republicans would get about 51% of the vote. But you can see that kind of distrust of the results because of all of the controversy around everything to do with this election.
Well, precincts did extend their hours because of issues all over Georgia. Three Fulton County polling places extended their hours until 9, 10 p.m. Booker T. Washington High School turned folks away after running out of provisional ballots and then extended their hours. Question for both of you. Common problems in Georgia elections, or have the polling mechanisms and processes and machinery in place caught up with the population growth in Georgia?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's very important, I think, for people to remember, given that there have been all of these accusations about Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, manipulating the elections, dealing with voter suppression accusations. It's very important to remember that the voting apparatus is in the hands of the counties, not the Secretary of State's office. So if there were counties where there were not enough voting machines and for people to get to in and out quickly, and by the way, it was a very long ballot, so that kept people at their station longer than they might otherwise have been. But that's a county issue, and that's something that that people should take up with their elected officials in the county. Say, why did you have three machines in a precinct where you had people waiting for 2 hours? Those are budgetary issues. But that's not something to take up with the Secretary of State. That's something that you as a citizen can do with your county commission. What's wrong with you that we don't have enough machines?
So you mentioned how long the ballot was. Some ballot initiatives, Marcy's Law passed with a majority of the vote, Georgia Outdoor Stewardship Fund to protect the environmental resources in the state. Any real surprises there, Bill?
You know, not really. Marcy's Law, on the surface, sounds like, how can you
say no to victims' rights?
I will tell you something interesting about Marcy's Law, though. In its original form, it gave victims a much more powerful ability to weigh in on criminal proceedings throughout a case as it made its way through courts. The reality is that amendment was defanged quite a bit, and it really offers kind of minimal protections. So we'll see how it unfolds as it is enacted.
Early exit polling showed number one issue driving voters to the polls nationally, health care. How can we expect health care in Georgia to change due to this election? Or will we not know until we have a governor in place?
Well, I mean, Stacey Abrams wanted to expand Medicaid. That was the number one thing she ran on. And she didn't win. Or we don't think at this point she's going to win. We'll still see. If Brian Kemp is the governor, he's not going to expand Medicaid. He's going to look for certain kind of waivers that people hope will help improve the health care situation in the state. But it was Stacey Abrams' showcase issue, and unless she forces a runoff, it's gone by the wayside.
So just a half a minute here, but Trump declared that this midterm election would be a referendum on his presidency.
Well, you know, here's what's interesting about that. If you look at the entire country, it was, in fact, suburban voters who said, we're not happy with President Trump. And in suburbs across the country, the places where Democrats picked up seats were people who apparently didn't think much of Donald Trump. That's exactly what happened in Cobb County and Gwinnett County last night. Suburban voters turned against many of their Republicans, and we can only imagine it's partly a protest against President Trump.
Well, Bill Nygut, we're going to be hearing a lot more about this on your shows in the coming days. Host of Political Rewind, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks.
And also Maya Prabhu, thank you from the AJC for taking some time with us after a long, long day. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, this was supposed to be the year of the woman. Well, we're going to look at whether it lived up to its name and whether indeed the nation is ready to embrace female leadership. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is On Second Thought. Stay with us. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, 2018 has been called the Year of the Woman, and the midterm election is delivering on that name. More than 100 women are newly elected to Congress, which is a new record. It's also a reason that Democrats will be taking control of the U.S. House. 98 women have been elected to that chamber, most of them Democrats. And the results have come as women increasingly have spoken out against sexual harassment and discrimination. But this is not the first Year of the Woman. 1992 earned the same name after Anita Hill spoke up about sexual harassment. The UN called 1975 the International Women's Year. So will this Year of the Woman create lasting change? It makes future feminist waves moot. Well, Sherry Randolph is here to help us answer that. She teaches history at Georgia Tech. Sherry, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And also Don Bennett Alexander teaches employment law at UGA. Don, thank you for being here.
You are so welcome. Thank you, Virginia.
Now, there's been a lot of slicing and dicing and analysis of the races, so we're going to focus a little bit differently on women's leadership and style. And, well, first of all, we've been here before this Year of the Woman. How is this year any different, Sherry?
Yeah, I think it's both and. So it's a continuation of kind of a backlash to something that usually happens. There's some repression in this past 2 years. There's been Donald Trump repression and then wide-scale organizing as a result. Both politically, we're seeing the election of women not just in Senate and Congress, but also you see the election of many, especially in Texas, some court judges are women and a diversity of races. So that's been really exciting. And we saw that, of course, in 75 and then in 92.
Research has shown that people, for women, consciously or subconsciously considered less worthy of power. Mm. And they show women's voices considered less authoritative, women considered inherently worse at some professions. So with so much discrimination, is our culture ready for a Year of the Woman?
I think probably the last election, 2016, was a really good example of the answer of that being no. it really was a rejection of what was admittedly one of the most qualified women, people who had ever run for president in the history of the presidency. Mm. And research will show you that women tend to concentrate on things like being qualified and the things they have to do in order to meet that. And the truth is, that's not always what the acceptable thing is that people are used to, because they are going up against that narrative of the things that you mentioned, Virginia.
So
and that
there's
is still
a gulf.
There. Every day, that's still there.
And I think if we break that down intersectionally, we know that Black women
absolutely
vote partisan. They vote for their interests most consistently since they had the right to vote. where we don't necessarily see that with white women, and even in the election of Stacey Abrams. So we know that white women, even if they were against him, thought he was racist, sexist, so forth, Kavanaugh, all of it, they still voted in Georgia's almost 70% for Kemp. So, you know, with the year of the woman, we also see women kind of breaking down differently in how they support issues that are important to them.
Well, I think that may be part of the problem, is looking at women as a monolith, especially there's a long simmering divides between the women's movement among women of color and white women, certainly. But, you know, in order to form a movement, how do you reckon that there are different needs, political priorities when you are creating a movement? Or is this a movement? Is it just an expression of people saying, yeah, we want, well, women are capable of power too?
I
was just going to say, I think that one of the big things that we are just now probably finally realizing is that when you have a movement like that, one of the things that makes it successful is understanding from the beginning that all of us see through our own lens.
Yeah.
And if you've got around a table a group of white women, they, even though they have diverse experiences, they are going to still be going through the world a certain way with certain kinds of experiences that are common to them that are not common to black women or other women of color. Including those people from the beginning makes for a much broader appeal. And black women tend to stay away, as most women would, most people would, from something that does not seem to include them. One of the lessons, I think, and I think they build on each other over the years, but one of the lessons, I think, from the more recent events has been that you really have to have all the voices at the table if you want all of those voices to show up for you in the end.
Well, let's hear just a little comment. This is from Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking last night about the Year of the Woman.
So tonight is a night to celebrate how far our movement has come. But it is also a night to remember just how it began. And let's make sure that nobody rewrites history. This resistance began with women, and it is being led by women tonight.
So she's talking about a movement. Of course, this is this month, or last month rather, the anniversary of the Me Too movement becoming popularized. Millions of people claimed it all over the world. It's actually a movement created more than 10 years ago by a woman named Tarana Burke. Mm-hmm. But let's look at this idea of the kind of movement. You know, you teach, Dawn, you teach employment law, which covers sexual harassment. What has this movement done to help us understand about the power of women's stories and coming forward with them?
I think probably the thing that it's done most, in my estimation, is it's added bulk and a sort of resonance to their narratives and made them understand how important they were. When this happened before, and I never expected us to be here 27 years later, but when it happened before with Anita Hill, there were repercussions of it that did not surface until afterwards. Women watched as she was sat in the confirmation hearings being castigated for her truth, her narrative. And it wasn't until after that happened that they declared the Year of the Woman, because so many people who realized what she was going through rose up and started running for office. But the talk around it, I think, was quite different than it was this time. And the reverberations were really sort of interesting. My course, and I wrote the first and leading, still leading, textbook in employment law for business. It came out of Anita Hill. It was dedicated to her because nobody would listen to me saying, you know, you really need to listen to this sleeping giant called sexual harassment because it's going to rise up at some point and bite you. And publishers didn't want to deal with a book that there was no market for. And as it turns out, after what happened with Anita Hill, I had competing contracts on my desk because they all wanted a very strong chapter. They wanted the book and they wanted a very strong chapter on it. That, you would think, would have sort of raised it to a certain height that would make it so people now understood the issue. There was a resource for them to use. They could learn it in school and take it into the workplace. As it turned out, not so much, because we are also dealing with the narrative of the men who grew up acculturated a certain way that sure. tells them that this sort of thing is okay to do or to not even recognize it when it's happening. 20 years later, we're seeing the implications of that, where for decades this has been going on. And finally, when Me Too came along, even though, as you said, it came along with Tarana Burke in 2006.
But really caught on.
Yeah, it really caught on. And people's stories seemed to be the most important part of it. Those stories, because I think they were so personal and there were so many of them, ended up resonating with people in a very different way.
Well, you mentioned that this has been so long in coming, 1991, the Anita Hill hearings. Mm-hmm. But you know, also, I feel like I'm a Gen X woman, and I think I saw those hearings and I thought, oh, okay, well, you know, a woman standing up for herself against harassment or discrimination, guess nothing much happens. You just figure out how to work through the system. But now a younger generation of women saying, no, I'm not willing to do that. I mean, is this generational, do you think, Sherry, in some ways?
Well, I always say, you know, history is ebbs and flows. It's not straight upwards motion. And so we see a quote-unquote Me Too movement, the personal is political, if you will, that phrase that comes out of the 50s and 60s. Feminists borrowed that from actually the civil rights movement, when people would tell their stories in the civil rights movement, and telling their stories of being discriminated against, being raped, and so forth, became the impetus for many civil rights battles. And so you saw that in the 30s. You see it now. We know so much more about Rosa Parks and standing up against discrimination and fighting against discrimination. Verese Taylor brilliant book by Daniel McGuire talks about rape as really the catalyst for the civil rights movement and Black women speaking up about that. So I don't think this is new to the train, women speaking up. I think we're seeing the ebb and flow of that wave of it's hidden in plain sight, and now everyone's kind of caught the media attention. And I think one of the reasons also is social media, because we wouldn't probably know about, I always knew about Tarana Burke because she lives in New York, and I knew of her work and so forth. And we share many of the same friends and run in the same circles. But it was social media and Black Twitter and Black social media that was like, no, there was a Black woman who came up with this hashtag first and enforced that issue. And she probably would have been forgotten. And we see that. And we see that in so many historical moments. So I think this moment is important because as a historian, I think it's important to label a moment. And we are seeing these kind of magnificent changes. Also in people being registered to vote, voters that have been forgotten, younger voters, people, women of color, Muslim women, Native American women, you know, there's a lot of firsts. And that's a little bit crazy. I think the first Native American woman.
Right. You know, first African American woman in Massachusetts.
That's,
I mean,
right.
A lot of firsts.
First openly gay, you know, and it seems crazy. But that's also a brilliant part of this generation that's helping to form these intersectional movements. And
a little update that on that, too. That's Sherry Randolph. She's from Georgia Tech. Don Bennett Alexander from the University of Georgia, also with me. We just got a notice that the Stacey Abrams campaign was going to hold an election update press call at 10 o'clock this morning. Also, let's see, with 100% reporting, Lucy McBath has a 50.3% of the votes in Georgia's 6th Congressional District, 2,000-vote lead over Karen Handel, according to the AP. Mm-hmm. So a lot to unfold here as we're watching, you know, whether, you know, certainly the year of the woman has borne out in congressional races, but what does it mean in a larger sense? And I guess that's a big question. The Me Too movement also affected the way we think about power, gender dynamics. Mm-hmm. Monica Lewinsky said in Vanity Fair that the movement made her think what happened between former President Bill Clinton and she. Here's Clinton with the Today Show's Craig Melvin.
I apologize to everybody in the world.
But you didn't apologize to her.
I have not talked to her.
Do you feel like you owe her an apology?
No, I do not. I have never talked to her. But I did say publicly on more than one occasion that I was sorry.
Well, so sorry to the American people, I guess. This is the big question, you know, that how politically, people have aligned against the man in power. I think a lot of women now regret lining up behind Clinton. Yeah. Do you think that's true?
I think I would hope some people regret that or have a more nuanced way to understand power. So it's just not about the individuals. It's about a system that allows us to demonize the woman. So when he says he apologized to the people, he also means he apologized to his wife, do you know, or he apologized to his daughter, you know, and that she's insignificant or any abuse of power is insignificant in the face of everything that happened to him. And so understanding why we think that way is the same kind of conversation that was happening with Kavanaugh.
Right.
Do you know, where people are outraged, they thought he did it, you know, all, you know. There, I mean, you have the perfect, you know, you have the perfect witness coming against him. So you don't find many people saying, no, no, she's not credible, because we do that with quote unquote, rape victims and so forth. But I think what's so key with that is that in this moment, you're actually seeing people using their public voices to also change policy. So to elect women who share the policies that they hope to see, and to also as a pushback against Trump. I think that's very clear. And we see that throughout history, and we're seeing it in this moment. So hopefully it'll be effective. So
I think probably both a pushback against him as well as a support for him. Because
yes.
If you think about it, the districts, or I should say the states, in which there was Democratic resistance mm-hmm. in Congress for the Kavanaugh hearings, where they said, you know, we don't like your candidate, we don't want to vote for him, those people got voted out.
Yeah.
And it's really bizarre when you think about the enormous kind of movement there was in the diverse candidates that ended up winning. The
yeah.
ones that you talked about, Sherry, in terms of the first gay governor, the two Native American women, the two Muslim women.
Yeah.
That against a Senate that, you know, and those women gaining 31 seats to join the other 96 that are already there. And then on the other hand, in the Senate, people voting out the people who were against Kavanaugh.
Yeah.
So the idea of even having, you know, sort of this year of the woman, I think in some ways that's true. But like you said, it's quite nuanced, and all women are not a monolith, as you mentioned, Virginia. And we have women who absolutely voted to continue Trump's legacy.
Yeah.
One of the things I think is really incredible about this great big movement that tends to happen with women's issues is that it tends to be on the back of something sexual.
Yeah.
That is just sort of bizarre. We can't be recognized for who we are and what we bring to the table. And what we bring to the table is tremendous, because we cover all issues, not just business issues, not just issues of war. We want the well-being of everyone, and that is not why we end up at the table. We end up at the table because somebody starts to, you know, react to something that happened sexually to us. And like you said, even Sherry, with the civil rights movement,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
that sort of
yeah.
being the basis for that whole movement, the rape of black women, that ends up telling us something about whether we really are dealing with equality or a sort of forced reckoning of this place that we come to that has built little by little over the years.
Mm.
And you know, then the question becomes, do we really care as long as we're sitting at the table?
I'm so sorry that I got us, you know, the year of the woman's rolling on apparently, but we have to stop our conversation with Sherry Randolph, Associate Professor of History at Georgia Tech. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don Bennett Alexander, Associate Professor of Employment Law and Legal Studies. She's at UGA's Terry College of Business. You know, clearly we have a lot more in this conversation, and that is our show for today. Thanks so much for tuning into On Second Thought, and please stay with GPB all day and GPB online to keep abreast of what's going on in this race.